Lecture 16, Elijah.
The song Swing Low, Sweet Chariot is well known and well loved. On the other hand, many of us have heard the expression, she's a Jezebel, she's a painted woman. We might like to sing the song, we would not like to be called Jezebel. Part of the problem here is most people are unaware of the origins of either song or expression. For those origins and others which have increasingly influenced contemporary American culture, we have to go back and have a look at the story of Jezebel herself, her husband King Ahab, who shares a name with the ill-fated whaler in Moby Dick, and also with the prophet Elijah, for whom that chariot in fact did swing low, and within the whirlwind in the chariot, Elijah himself is brought up into heaven. Now, when we say swing low, sweet chariot, are we asking to be brought up into heaven immediately, or might we have work on earth to do first? To understand Elijah and Jezebel and Ahab, we have to know something about the intertwining of religion and politics in ancient Israel. There was then no separation of church and state. So we'll do a little bit of background here just on the prophets so we know who they are. Biblical studies typically divides prophets into two groups. There is, on the one hand, the pre-classical prophets, and these are the prophets for whom we have adventures. And there is, on the other hand, the classical prophets, and classical prophets are those primarily from whom we have written oracles. Classical prophets would be folks like Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel. The distinction is based primarily on form, narrative description versus poetic oracle. But there is a greater distinction here, and that is what those particular prophets do. Pre-classical prophets were comparably much more interested in the actual workings of, rather than simply rhetoric concerning, the political situation. They were highly involved with politics, both on national and even international levels. Thus, while a classical prophet such as Amos would go to a shrine and there, in the site of religious practice, declaim the word of the Lord against self-complacent aristocracy, self-complacency in the court, a pre-classical prophet such as Elisha might arrange a coup, or such as Samuel or Ahijah proclaim a new king while a current king is already on the throne. Elijah is the epitome of the pre-classical prophet. Narrative is told about him. He operates on a national level. He anoints, in effect, Elisha as his successor, and the two of them together manipulate the politics of the Near East. As we noted in the last lecture, the kingdom of Solomon separates following his death into the kingdom of Israel in the north, comprised of 10 tribes who followed the lead of Jeroboam, and 2 tribes down in the south, Judah and Benjamin, who were still loyal to Rehoboam of the Davidic household. Elijah is involved with work up in the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, and this means we have to have a sense of the political leadership that's going on there. 1 Kings chapter 16 describes a coup by a fellow named Omri, and the circumstances of this coup are not uncommon for the northern kingdom. Briefly, here's how it works. Elijah, the son of Baasha, was king. Once, when he was drunk, his servant Zimri, commander of the chariot forces, killed him and took over the government. And Zimri did what any ancient Near Eastern king would do. He proceeded to kill all the members of Baasha's entire family, lest another heir arise to the throne. Word gets out that Zimri has killed the king. All Israel is entirely upset about this, and by Israel here I mean the northern kingdom. And they made the commander of the army, Omri, king over all Israel that day. Then, as now in many places of the globe, if you could command the army, you could command the throne. Zimri learns about this, and he commits suicide. He actually burns down the king's house with himself in it, and thus Zimri reigned only 7 days. Omri himself does not get very much attention in the biblical account. The Bible is interested in him primarily because he is the one who arranged the marriage of his son Ahab to a Phoenician princess whose name is Jezebel. and Ahab and Jezebel are major figures within the biblical tradition. However, and here's one of the ironies of biblical studies, characters the Bible considers to be not terribly important can be on the international scene exceptionally well known, and Omri is in fact recognized by external sources. Finally, we find people in the Bible about whom we can say, yes, they are historical figures, yes, they are attested by extra-canonical materials. The Moabite stone refers to, quote, Omri, king of Israel, who humbled Moab many years because Chemosh, our chief god, referring to the Moabites' chief god, was angry at his people. It goes on to note that Mesha, king of Moab, had to deliver annually to the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. And indeed, Assyrian records at about the same time refer to the kingdom of Israel as Omriland. This means that Ahab comes from a very astute family and a relatively secure political situation. Internally, Omri established the capital of the northern kingdom at Samaria. It had previously been at Shechem, about 7 miles away. And this is a good move on his part because it made it more able for Omri to have access to the Phoenician court. Like David's Jerusalem, in effect, Samaria is a new capital for a new regime. And like Solomon, Omri establishes extensive international relations as well as creates a period, at least initially, of great economic prosperity. Things in the north are looking excellent, unless one happens to be poor. Hence, it is against the early northern kingdom, not much later than the period under question, that the classical prophets Amos and Hosea begin their condemnation of the wealthy, the idolatrous, and those more interested in international trade than the poor within their own borders. In this respect, the Deuteronomic historian, the narrator of these stories, correctly classifies Omri as having, quote, done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. To establish political security, Omri and his household do what Solomon did. They arrange marriages in order to create international alliances. A woman named Athaliah, who was either Ahab's daughter or his sister, the biblical text gives both options, is married to Jehoram, the king of Judah, and this way, through marriage, the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah are connected. And as noted, Omri marries his son Ahab to Jezebel of Tyre, thus obtaining Phoenician protection from both Syria and Assyria, two empires on the rise, as well as gaining additional opportunities for trade with northern Africa, because northern Africa had strong Phoenician connections. The time period we're in now is somewhere around 869 to 850. Those are the usual dates given for King Ahab. 2 Kings chapter 10 notes that Ahab had 70 Samaritan sons, which sounds like he must have had a harem of Solomonic proportions, but I suspect this is rather simply a metaphor to express how loyal some of the people in Samaria were to him. Perhaps these 70 sons might be considered members of the royal court. In terms of wives, the only one listed for Ahab is Jezebel. And further on Omri, he sets up a political coalition with Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. So if you've heard the expression, jumping Jehoshaphat, this is he. Together they defeat Ben-Hadad of Syria and then join in an alliance against Assyria. And Ahab's contribution to the war effort, because it does continue, and this is attested in the annals of the Assyrian king Shalmaneser, was 10,000 infantry soldiers and 2,000 chariots. They were all sent to the Battle of Karkar, which took place in 853. Assyrian annals claim victory, but neither Syria nor Israel falls. Consequently, we know that Ahab, too, is a participant on the international military scene, and he has the funds to allow him a major role. Internally, either Omri or Ahab was also responsible for the new walls that replaced earlier ones, perhaps even built by Solomon, at Megiddo and Hazor, and Ahab and Omri also developed water systems. These are superb kings. However, internally there was a religious shift occurring. Queen Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of Tyre, and the wife of Ahab, sponsors worship of her own god, Baal-Melchart. And Baal-Melchart is then assimilated into Canaanite worship because Canaanites too worshipped Baal. Baal is a nature god primarily. We're told that Ahab built a temple to Baal in Samaria, and he also erected what's called an Asherah, or a sacred pole, and that was dedicated to the mother goddess. We are told by the text that Jezebel had 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the mother goddess eating at her table. In other words, the cultic staff of Jezebel's idolatrous religion is on the royal payroll. The text thus sets up Ahab in the mode of Solomon by showing that although he started out with a great kingdom, a golden age, economic prosperity, once he marries, the idolatrous practices of his wife will bring him down. And as we know from the biblical tradition over and over again, worship of foreign gods leads to disaster. As 1 Kings 16 puts it, Ahab did more to provoke the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than had all the kings of Israel who were before him. This is people like Baasha and Zimri, people the text does not appreciate. God's agent in punishing this wicked, wicked monarch is Elijah, a miracle worker, a prophet, a political manipulator whom King Ahab addresses directly as, "You troubler of Israel." What do we know of Elijah? He is identified as a Tishbite from the area of Gilead. This is somewhere east of the Jordan. We know that his primary theological concern was the worship of Israel's God only. 1 Kings describes his battles with Ahab and Jezebel and with their god Baal through narratives that in effect resemble folk tales. They're comparable in genre in some cases to the story of Balaam and his talking donkey in Numbers 22, or as we'll see later, to the story of Daniel placed in the lion's den in the book of Daniel. For example, here's our introduction to Elijah. He appears somewhat abruptly in 1 Kings 17. He comes to Ahab. How he gained access to the court, we do not know. And he predicts, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." In other words, there will be a drought and hence a famine. And then he leaves. But although Elijah has announced a drought, he himself will be miraculously fed by ravens who bring him bread and meat every morning and every evening. This is quite a menu. Meat is an extremely rare commodity in antiquity. Most people did not eat meat at all. And when meat was eaten, it was usually in the context of a sacrificial offering. It was a form of worship to offer meat as a sacrifice and then consume some of the sacrificial product oneself. Most people have no food at all at this point. Elijah is having miraculous feedings by ravens of meat. Moreover, he has water because he is east of the Jordan by a wadi that God had provided for him. Not only is Elijah miraculously fed, he can also miraculously feed others. When the wadi from which he had been getting water eventually dries up, God sends him to the village of Zarephath. It's in the region of Sidon, that is Jezebel's home territory, Phoenician territory, to the home of a widow. When Elijah sees the widow gathering sticks, the text doesn't provide her a name, but she's there, she's gathering sticks. He says to her, "Bring me a little water in a vessel so that I may drink." And she, with great hospitality and quite complacently, heads off to do just this. And as she's leaving, he calls out, "Oh, by the way, also bring me some bread." Pushy prophet. This is asking quite a lot. There is a famine going on, and the famine is being caused by the drought, which is affecting not only Israel, it's also affecting Phoenicia. And the widow is poor. She says to Elijah, "Look, as the Lord your God lives," and I wonder if that "your God" rather than "my God" is some hint that she realizes Elijah's God is responsible for the drought. "As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked. I have only a handful of meal in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I am now gathering a couple of sticks so that I make a home and prepare food for myself and my son, that we may eat and then die. There will be no food left." Elijah comforts this woman in a way that Baal, the nature god, the god who was supposed to be able to provide rain and provide grain, cannot. Elijah actually provides her with a jar. He says, "Your jar of meal will never be empty, and your jug of oil will never give out until the famine ends." People familiar with the story of Maccabees may recall here the miraculous cruse of oil, which was only supposed to last in burning for one day, but lasted for eight, and that's the miracle of Hanukkah. One can find cross-culturally jars, wells, cauldrons, vessels, from which food is remarkably taken out and is always replenished. Here is the Hebrew text version of that particular myth theme, as it's called, folktale motif. This scene is reinforced in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 4, by Jesus, who in a sermon in a synagogue in Nazareth talks about God's generosity to the Phoenician widow. And Jesus' point there, which I believe is in part the same point we have here in the Deuteronomic history, is that Gentiles too benefit from divine grace. Now, even better for the woman, when her son becomes ill, she accuses Elijah of punishing her. She says, "You have come to bring my sin to remembrance and cause my death." This is also good Deuteronomic theology, because Deuteronomic theology says, if you behave properly, you will be rewarded. If you sin, you will be punished. The woman assumes she is being punished, therefore she recollects a past sin. But Elijah will not only provide her food, he will also provide her son life. He takes the child and stretches out his body on top of the boy three times. The scene has actually been compared to a form of CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. But he calls out, "O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again," and the child is revived. And here we have, and any ancient reader would have known it, a polemic against Baal worship. Because according to Canaanite and Phoenician mythology, every year Baal would die and he would have to be resurrected by the goddess Anat. Baal cannot resurrect himself. Elijah, the prophet of the true God, is able to bring back from death a Gentile woman's son. Elijah's miracles are passed along to his successor, Elisha. So within the pre-classical prophetic tradition, we find numerous miracles, some grandiose, some great, such as resurrection. Elisha can control wild animals. He can make an axe head float. He can cure leprosy. And of course, he can cure infertility. Indeed, Elisha had a group of prophets following him. They're called sons of the prophets, and it may well have been this group of prophets who recorded the stories of both Elijah and Elisha. Now, all these miracles that I've described concerning Elijah occur in 1 Kings 17. He has spoken one line to King Ahab, and then he does miracles in Phoenician territory. Then, in the third year of the drought, the Lord sends him back to Ahab. On the way, he meets Obadiah, the palace manager. When Jezebel had been murdering the prophets of God, Obadiah managed to rescue 100 of them, whom he kept 50 to a cave, and he provided them bread and water, which during a drought is a miracle itself. Elijah tells Obadiah to announce his return, but Obadiah is hesitant. He's already in trouble because he's hiding these prophets whom Jezebel had planned on killing, and he tells Elijah that Ahab had been searching for Elijah. It is as if there's a bounty on his head. Elijah has to assure Obadiah that God will protect him, at which point Obadiah goes to Ahab and announces that Elijah has returned. It is at this point when Ahab says to Elijah, "You troubler of Israel." Ahab apparently believes Elijah is responsible for the drought. Elijah responds, "Not I, but you and your father's house, because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and you have followed the Baals." Therefore, Ahab and Elijah will have to have a contest to see who is the true troubler of Israel. And indeed, Elijah arranges with Ahab a contest between God and Baal on Mount Carmel. There, 450 prophets of Baal prepare the sacrifice of a bull, and as the carcass of the bull lies on the altar, they wait for Baal to send flames from heaven to consume the carcass. As they wait, they dance around the altar in an ecstatic dance. They anticipate their God to consume the sacrifices. In a form of sympathetic magic, they cut themselves with swords and let the blood flow. And in fact, this type of prophetic mutilation through frenzy is actually attested of Phoenician priests by an Egyptian traveler in about the year 1100 BCE. So this may be an historical reminiscence. Elijah, meanwhile, taunts them. "Cry aloud," he says. "Surely he's a god." Well, either he's meditating, or he has wandered away, which basically means he's attending to nature, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened. "Cry louder." And of course, Elijah is here being completely disrespectful. But we're told there is no voice and no answer and no response. So Elijah rebuilds the altar to God that had been destroyed. He provides his own sacrifice, and indeed he even builds a trench around the altar and fills it with water, because the miracle will be when fire comes down. So this is just one more test that God will have to pass. Of course, fire from the Lord fell from heaven, consuming the animals and the water. And interestingly enough, at this point, Elijah says to Ahab, "Eat and drink." Indeed, eat and drink from that sacrificial offering. And Ahab here participates in taking part. Ahab here takes part in that sacrifice. It is a form of worship, as if Ahab is torn between Baal worship on the one hand and worship of his God, Elijah's God, on the other. Elijah, having succeeded in this contest, kills the prophets of Baal. When Jezebel hears about all this, she's understandably miffed about the whole incident, and she vows revenge. She sends a message to Elijah that says, "So may the gods do to me and more also if I don't make your life like the life of one of those you have killed." Elijah is now a little scared and he flees. Indeed, he flees as far south as he could go to Beersheba, which is in Judah, and so out of Jezebel and Ahab's political control. He then goes to the wilderness to die. He is convinced he can do no more. But an angel appears to him. The angel makes sure he eats enough to keep up his strength. Indeed, this entire story of Ahab and Jezebel and Elijah plays on motifs of famine and food over and over. The angel provides him food, and at that point, Elijah went on the strength of the food for 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. And here, with 40 days and 40 nights, we may recall Israel's 40 years in the wilderness, when they, in fact, are fed miraculous food, manna and quail, and also Jesus' time of testing when he is out in the wilderness for 40 days, and one of the temptations to him, because he's hungry and fasting, is turn these stones into bread, and Jesus responds, "Man does not live by bread alone." Now we have Elijah on Mount Horeb, and here he experiences a theophany, a manifestation of God. And Horeb, as we saw in the Moses lecture, is another name for Mount Sinai. So Elijah is now placed in the Moses role, somebody who provides food for his people, or in this case, for a Gentile widow, somebody who experiences a theophany on Mount Horeb. But this theophany is quite different. Elijah witnesses wind, earthquake, and then fire. But God is neither in nor controlled by nature, because were God to manifest in wind or earthquake, in fire at this time, God would be acting like Baal. So rather than make a show of divine greatness, as the text ironically puts it, when Elijah heard, and Elijah hears nothing, when Elijah heard the silence, and you can't hear silence, obviously silence is the absence of sound, he wrapped himself in his cloak, and he went out, and he stood at the entrance to the cave. And there he hears a voice asking him, "Elijah, what are you doing here?" In other words, you're a prophet. You're not supposed to be sitting in the desert waiting to die. You're not supposed to be hiding in a cave. You're supposed to be out preaching the divine word, stopping Baal worship, and telling the king and queen how to behave properly. Elijah protests. He says, "Of all of Israel, I'm the only one who has been left loyal." Well, we may recall those 100 prophets of God whom Obadiah had hid, as well as Obadiah himself, who had stayed under Jezebel's territory at the risk of his own life to protect God's prophets. God says to Elijah, "Look, go anoint Hazazel king over Aram, and go anoint Jehu of Nimshi king of Israel." In other words, go restructure the political and religious situations of these various monarchies. whoever escapes from the sword of Hazazel, Jehu shall kill, and whoever escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall kill. Yet, says God, I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. And this should satisfy Elijah. And hence we see the pre-classical prophet on the international scene anointing new kings over Damascus, over Judea, indeed over Israel, because Elijah is now making sure that the world will correspond to what God needs. Elijah then takes off, and we do not see him for a moment. We have an interlude. The next chapter concerns King Ahab's war with Ben-Hadad of Syria. In 1 Kings chapter 20, Ahab is predicted as an able and even a just political leader. The scene then heightens the impression that the problems of his court are caused primarily with Jezebel. Had he been left on his own, he might have been a good king. In this particular war, he actually succeeds. The fact that Ben-Hadad of Syria is drunk most of the time helps. But Ahab also receives a prophecy of victory. However, Ahab is condemned for not fulfilling the rules of holy war, for not executing Ben-Hadad, whom God had devoted to destruction. The scene is reminiscent of Saul's sparing of Agag the Amalekite, whom Samuel hewed to pieces. We next come to a very famous scene called the story of Naboth's vineyard. Ahab had wanted to purchase the vineyard to set up a vegetable garden, but Naboth refused to sell, as he says, "The Lord forbid that I should give you my ancestral inheritance." And it's a horrible thing to tear up a vineyard and plant a vegetable garden. A vegetable garden, the vegetables will grow in one season. Vineyards take decades to produce decent crop. This should have ended the story when Naboth says no, but Jezebel, seeing that Ahab is depressed and refuses to eat, attempts to perk him up. "Get up," she says, "eat some food, I'll give you the vineyard." She winds up bribing false witnesses to charge Naboth with treason. Naboth is executed by stoning, and the land reverts to the state. Elijah then confronts Ahab in the vineyard and charges him with blood guilt. Because Naboth had no family remaining, God himself would avenge him. Thus says the Lord, "In the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, dogs will also lick your blood." And completing the menu, he adds, "The dog shall also eat Jezebel within the bounds of Jezreel." Ahab repents and God relents. As God puts it, "Because Ahab has humbled himself to me, I will not bring disaster in his days, but his sons, to them I will bring disaster." Ahab then dies in battle, even though he had disguised himself in hope that nobody would attack him. A certain man drew his bow and unknowingly struck the king of Israel. The blood flowed from his wounds and into the bottom of the chariot, and they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs came and licked the blood. And prostitutes, we're told, washed themselves in it. Within a few chapters, all is settled. Elijah commissions Elisha, and when Elijah is taken up to heaven in 2 Kings, Elisha receives his mantle. The scene is the breaking of the miraculous into the ordinary. As they continued walking and talking, we're told, a chariot of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them, and Elijah ascended to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha kept watching and crying out, "Father, Father." Elisha arranges the coup that deposes Ahab in favor of Jehu and helps facilitate the execution of Ahab's family. A few notes on Elijah's return. Since Elijah does not die, he is therefore appropriate for a messianic harbinger, and thus in both Judaism and Christianity, Elijah is expected to return before the coming of the Messiah. In the New Testament, John the Baptist fulfills the role of Elijah. Indeed, they even dress the same way. Elijah is described as a hairy man with a leather belt around his waist, and so too John the Baptist in the Gospel of Mark, clothed with camel's hair, with a leather belt around his waist. In terms of Jezebel's fate, before she dies, she paints her face, she puts on eye makeup, and she stands in the window, and she calls out to King Jehu, "Zimri, murderer of your master, is it peace?" Zimri, we recall, murdered the previous king. Jehu at this point says, "Anyone who was loyal to me, please act," and eunuchs throw Jezebel out the window. Her body is trampled by horses. Why is she called a prostitute later on in tradition? In part because she painted her eyes. But as we see in the text, Jezebel herself never committed any sexual crime. So here we see culture acting appropriately. If we find a strong woman, how best do we cast aspersions on her, accuse her of some sort of sexual infidelity? And we'll see even in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, a false prophet called Jezebel, and her punishment is to be thrown onto a bed. The sexual connections continue, and they continue all the way through contemporary American culture. We may recall Betty Davis's Jezebel, who befuddled Henry Fonda, or indeed The Robber Bride by Margaret Atwood, or Tom Robbins' evocations in Skinny Legs and All. Ultimately, the story also leaves us with questions. To what extent should religious figures be involved in international politics? To what extent should we judge politicians on the basis of the religion that they practice?